When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 109, A History of Mesoamerican Food, Part 2. In the last episode, we looked at the indigenous and Spanish inheritances which form the pillars of the cuisine of Mesoamerica, as well as a few surprising contributors to the cuisine. We haven't looked and the African contribution. Now, Mexico is not usually thought of as one of the Latin American countries which had a large African population. Now, this is true in comparison to some other countries, but there was some presence in certain parts of the region. There are still Afro-descendants in a couple of pockets of Mexico. The area known as the Costa Chica, part of the coast of Oaxaca, is one of them. The state of Veracruz on the east coast is another. Both of these places provided good conditions for plantations to grow cash crops, which is why the owners of those plantations created a demand for slaves. One of the most common ingredients used in Mexico, and one which was brought from West Africa, is the peanut. These were actually found in Brazil by the Portuguese, where they originally grew, but while the Iberians were not particularly interested in them at first, they did become very popular when they reached West Africa. From here they were taken back to the Americas by enslaved West Africans, and they caught on in Mexico in particular. They often served as a snack, having been roasted in spices in food carts, and also form one of the ingredients of some of the sauces which are commonly found on restaurant tables. African influences are more pronounced in southern Mesoamerica, in the Central American countries. The Afro-descended populations in coastal Guatemala, Honduras, and Belize are much more obvious than in Mexico. In those places, you can see some dishes which have a striking similarity to what you might find in places like Nigeria or Ghana. The use of coconut milk to stew meats and fish is one obvious technique. Rice and beans is the staple in much of this region, and this too comes from Africa. Plantains are certainly not uniquely Mesoamerican, being rarer in Mexico than elsewhere, and also being found across much of Latin America, particularly Colombia, Venezuela, and Panama. They are there, though, and they come from West Africa. There is one more historic genre of food which made its way to become part of the cuisine of Mesoamerica today. That is, food which spread through interaction within the Spanish Empire. While fish would have been widely eaten on the coasts of Mesoamerica, and maybe even raw sometimes, the ceviche, as we know it, was born on the Pacific coast of South America. Now it can be found across Latin America in coastal towns, including the countries which make up Mesoamerica. The milanesa is also often seen on Mexican menus. This is basically an Austrian breaded schnitzel, which made its way with emigrants from that country to northern Italy. This is why it's named after the city of Milan. From there it was taken to Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and southern Brazil, and then it spread across the Americas. The tamale is an example which went the other way. If you haven't seen them before, they are a mixture of corn dough and any one of many different ingredients, wrapped in the husk of the corn plant or in a banana leaf, and steamed with boiling water. They have caught on elsewhere and can now be found all over Latin America. In places like Colombia, many regions even have their own local, special form of tamale. They have, however, been made for thousands of years in Mesoamerica. It may be that similar dishes developed independently in other parts of the pre-Hispanic Americas, but most likely they spread from Mexico and Guatemala. In Nicaragua, the nacatamale is extremely popular, while in the Andean countries they are called humitas. Of course, today Mesoamerica is connected to our globalized world. People have moved to the region and brought their food with them. Sometimes people have moved from countries like the UK and the USA and set up restaurants which serve food from third cultures, which had already made those countries their home. This is particularly true in the tourist hotspots which cater for a Western market. While not traditionally parts of Mesoamerican cuisine, it's extremely easy to find things like burgers, hot dogs, pizza and pasta. In major towns and cities, you'll also find restaurants selling Indian and Chinese food, or sushi. Of course, we can't talk about a cuisine without also talking about drinks. Coffee is something which parts of Mesoamerica excel at producing. The crop originally comes from Ethiopia, but spread around the world to be grown in the tropical highlands in which it thrives, from Indonesia to Brazil. Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and the Mexican states of Chiapas, Tabasco, Oaxaca, and Veracruz have all been centers of coffee growing for a long time. Guatemala and Chiapas are particularly good for growing the crop, and plantation economies grew up there to produce it. In the 1800s, German immigrants came and set up small holdings to make their fortunes, and there are still elements of German culture in remote parts of mountainous Central America and Chiapas. Although these areas have long produced excellent coffee, it was and is done for export. This means that many of those involved in its production didn't really drink it, and there wasn't the culture surrounding it which developed in places like Europe. This has changed a bit in recent years, partly because Western cafe culture has arrived, rather than being something which has developed locally. Among the most famous drinks with origins in Mesoamerica are, of course, tequila and mezcal. Tequila is actually a type of mezcal made in a particular region, around the town of the same name in the state of Jalisco. Like with wine, the unique local conditions of the soil in which the agave used to make it is grown, and the weather it experiences there make a difference to the taste of the final product. Besides the region it is produced in, what makes tequila different from mezcal is the use of a specific type of agave plant. Mezcal's traditional heartland is in the state of Oaxaca, to the south of that of tequila. The origin of these spirits is not an ancient pre-Hispanic one. Instead, it's a globalized story which takes in three continents. Every alcohol needs some kind of base to be fermented. In this case, the agave plant. This is native to Mesoamerica, and the indigenous people did use it to make alcohol, which we'll come to in a minute. The Spanish, of course, drank beer and wine, and the colonists would probably have preferred to keep drinking them. The Spanish crown, however, made it difficult for them. Most of the flow of wealth in their empire came from the colonies and went back to Iberia. Mines provided silver, for example, while plantations provided things like sugar, tobacco, and coffee. And all of this went to Europe. The Spanish authorities, though, were concerned that the economy of their home country might collapse if it was unable to produce things for sale abroad. The empire and its people possessed the knowledge, land, and space to make Spanish alcohols in large quantities, probably enough to outstrip domestic Spanish production. It was decided that beer and wine would be two things which Spain alone could produce, and that, instead of making them, the colonies would provide a market. To ensure this, high taxes were imposed on beer and wine from the Americas, basically making them unviable as industries. The people of Mesoamerica began looking around for alternatives, but weren't keen on the indigenous drinks. Soon, though, the means to create a brand new drink emerged from an unexpected direction.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Philippines was a part of the Spanish Empire by the mid-1500s, and this was one often overlooked step in the development of our globalized world. This is something I want to do a podcast series on soon, because I think it's fascinating and want to know about it myself. There were already ships going between the Americas and Europe, as well as between Europe and East Asia, by rounding the bottom of Africa. A new route developed, which linked the Philippines with Mexico, specifically Acapulco. So now Spanish trade routes, for the first time, circled the globe. The two places, Mexico and the Philippines, as well as its neighbours like China to a lesser extent, had much more impact on each other than we commonly realise. People travelled across the Pacific, and they brought goods and ideas with them. The Filipinos had developed two related alcohols of their own, tuba, made from the sap of palm trees, and lambanog, which is its distilled cousin. Both are still drunk in some of the western coastal states of Mexico, and lambanog is known as vino de coco there. It was the Filipino stills which had been brought over for distilling vino de coco, which allowed the colonists of New Spain to take their indigenous agave-based tradition to create a new spirit which they found to their liking. Mezcal and tequila were born, and I probably don't need to tell you too much about them. They are well known and popular everywhere. The indigenous agave alcohol I mentioned a moment ago does survive in the form of pulque. Not being distilled, this is much less strong and is more comparable to beer. It's often served in pub-like establishments called pulquerias, and in glasses which look a lot like those beer is served in. That's where the similarities end, however. It is quite bizarre to those whose palates were not shaped in Mesoamerica. It looks like milkshake, but it has a sliminess to it, which, if I'm honest, puts a lot of people off. In pre-Hispanic times, it was considered holy, related to the goddess Mayahuel, and drunk by priests as part of their rituals. During the colonial era, its sacredness was forgotten, and its social status was reversed. It became popular with the lower classes and associated with public nuisance. Laws were put in place which limited the number of pulquerias permitted in Mexico City, and paintings depicted lower classes and indigenous people drinking it, passing out or fighting. Once independence was gained, it suddenly became seen as a source of Mexican pride, and its popularity exploded. It shed some of its lower class image, and people of all statuses drank it. Pulque is a boom and bust drink, though, and in the 20th century, its consumption dropped off dramatically. It once again came to be seen as a lower class drink. The main reason for this was the growth of beer. Once Mexico was independent, those heavy taxes on the industry were gone. But by this point, things like pulque, mezcal, and tequila had taken over. It seems that rather than creating a market for their beer in Mexico, the Spanish had killed off the Mexican taste for it. As in many parts of Latin America, it was the Germans who revived beer culture in Mexico, when some of them emigrated there. Today, Mexico is probably the Latin American country with the biggest beer industry. It certainly has more big beer brands than any other. Corona, Tecate, and Sol are commonly found around the world, while others like Dos Equis, Modelo, Pacifico, and Victoria are hugely popular within the country, and now increasingly found elsewhere. The Germans brought the Lager and Pilsen techniques, which they knew from home, and which most beers around the world use these days. Some of the brands I just mentioned make other types of beer like stouts as well, though. Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Belize also have a couple of national brands each, all pretty much lagers. In Belize, though, Guinness is very popular, although it's different from the standard Irish Guinness, as the locals were so proud of telling me when I visited. Stouts, in general, are popular in Belize. I don't know why. I don't think it's anything related to their pre-Hispanic history. Presumably it's because it was a British colony, and stouts used to be popular there as well. But it doesn't explain why other ex-British colonies prefer lager. So finally, I recently learned that there's such a thing as Mexican wine. I was talking to a local chef, and he was enthusiastically talking it up, saying it was better than Argentinian wine. It turns out that there is a wine industry, and that it does produce some good products. This makes sense, I guess, considering that California is where much of the USA's wine is produced. Mexico's vineyards are largely concentrated just over the border. 90% of them are in Baja California. It also turns out that it was wine produced in this region in the early days of the colony which so bothered the Spanish crown and inspired it to introduce its protectionist tax measures and favour wine produced at home. Only two unexpected groups of people really produced wine in Mexico up until the mid-20th century. The priests of California did it so that they would have some for communion. They were also apparently involved in small-scale and illegal tax-avoiding sales of the stuff they produce, which I think is pretty funny. Then, at the beginning of the 20th century, an obscure sect of Russian Orthodox pacifists, named the Moluccans, decided to settle in Baja California. There they made wine. Theirs is quite a strange story. Their beliefs apparently differ from the mainstream Russian church. Among other things, they believe it's okay to eat dairy while fasting, so they are sometimes nicknamed the Cheese Eaters in Russia. They were persecuted for their faith, and spread out across the countries of the former Russian Empire to avoid this. Others decided to emigrate completely. Apparently there are communities in the USA, Australia, and Uruguay, and this small portion decided to make their homes in northern Mexico. It seems that they played a role in preserving and reviving Mexico's wine industry, although its development has only really come on since the 1980s. You don't see much wine around in Mexico, to be honest, whether that be Mexican or foreign, but I'm sure it can easily be found in fancy restaurants. And so that brings our history of Mesoamerican cuisine to a close. I hope you found it interesting. Next time, we'll be sticking in the same region to start telling the story of Oñate's expeditions into New Mexico. If you've enjoyed this episode, and you feel like doing something to help out, one thing which I find extremely useful is if you could leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps new people discover the show. If you're interested in getting extra bonus episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast for just $2 a month. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of these things already. And thank you to everyone for listening.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast. Written and produced by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. Here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.